The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Good evening to you from inside. That would mean that we are, not yourselves, the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. Of course, it happens. Hire Hensley. My name is jQuery. Mike Thompson here as well. Landon Coons helps put it all together. This is Beyond the Bricks, meaning that it is once again the month of May in Indianapolis. We thank you for listening to us, whether you're listening live on the radio, whether you're listening after the fact via podcast form. We are most grateful for that, and we have so much fun each and every year doing this. Hard to believe this is our fifth year of Beyond the Bricks. Mike, one of the things that I really enjoy about doing Beyond the Bricks is each year I will think to myself, okay, what are the anniversary races that we will look forward to? For example, we have looked back at, you know, Danny Sullivan 1985. We've talked about Jacques Villeneuve in 1995 since we are in 2025. But there are those races as well that were so impactful, kind of bolder in the streams, if you will, sometimes races that regardless of whether or not they have some sort of a mathematical connotation to the year that we're talking about, we've got to take a look at them if we're talking about the history of the Indy 500. And that certainly includes the race that we're going to revisit tonight.
Yeah, that's correct. I think this one is so historic, even though it doesn't, you know, usually we're kind of looking at the ones that end in a five this year or end in a zero. But this one is just so historic. It's just too important to leave out 1977.
Hard to believe that we're just a couple, you know, 2 years away from the 50th anniversary of this race. But you know, to begin, I recall at the beginning of, actually at the end of April, so a few weeks ago here, the Can-Can Theater, which is a wonderful cinema on kind of the near east side of Indianapolis. That's Can-Can with K's, by the way, K-A-N-K-A-N. They began a series of showing films that relate to racing in order to kind of ramp up towards the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And one of those nights that they had involved just showing different archival footage of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and that included showing a lot from the 1977 race, kind of the post-race vignettes, if you will. But there was so much, Mike, that went into that race, because oftentimes when we talk about the Indianapolis 500 and look back at a year, you know, it's pretty simple, right? You talk about qualifying, who won the pole, and then maybe an event or two that happened in the race itself. That was not the case with 1977, because you had history being made before the month began, history being made during the course of the race and as the result of the race, and then also history being made in a couple of areas that we didn't realize until after the race was complete. So we will unpack all of that, if you will, in talking about everything that went in to the month of May. But let's begin with, if you will, some of the positives that happened in 1977, because there were a few things that happened historically, you know, moving forward beyond the race that, you know, in terms of losses and things like that. But let's begin with what happened in 1977, historically speaking, that was, again, bolder in the stream or noteworthy events. And this actually, the first that we're going to talk about, Mike, even though 1977 is the year that we will always talk about when it comes to this event, it really kind of started to form itself in 1976.
Yeah, that's correct, because, you know, Janet Guthrie made her debut in 1976. tried to become the first female driver in the history of the race. Didn't make the race in 76, but made a really good showing and showed that she was going to be a force to contend with later on, and she was probably going to make the race in the future, and it would end up that 1977 would be her year.
And so 1977, Janet Guthrie arrives, and of course, it may be, especially for younger people, difficult to grasp or not something they're aware of, but this was an era where you still kind of had the remnants, maybe even were still in it, of a lot of people within racing that thought that, you know, women in the pits were bad luck, and, you know, along with the word peanuts, and, you know, there's all kinds of superstitions in the world of racing, but it was still a man's sport. I mean, there's no question about that. And then along comes Janet Guthrie, and the acceptance of Janet Guthrie, if you will, at 16th and Georgetown. Janet Guthrie talked with WIBC's Terry Stacey, and that was one of the topics that came up, just the overall acceptance period for her at IMS.
At the beginning, there was a great deal of suspicion, but I had driven my first IndyCar race at Trenton, New Jersey, at the beginning of May, before I first arrived at the Speedway in May of 76. And that had done a little bit toward persuading the oval track racing drivers that I wasn't going to kill them all. There were some who were open-minded at the beginning, willing to take a look at what I did on a racetrack and make up their minds based on that. Johnny Rutherford was open-minded. I took a look at what I was doing. A.J. Foyt was open-minded, took a look at what I was doing. A.J. was one of the first to tell the newspapers that it looked all right to him.
And of course, having that endorsement, especially in that year, foreshadowing, would be noteworthy. But in terms of Janet Guthrie, it is hard to believe, but for a lot of drivers, of course, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, not saying it wasn't with Janet Guthrie, but that is the ultimate goal for any racer, is the fact that you want to get to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Oftentimes you would hear stories about a driver that would come to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and it was a place that they had been to as a kid, and that kind of started the fire within them, or the drive, the desire, or perhaps they had come at some point during a test in Indianapolis or a pass through Indianapolis to see the track itself. For Janet Guthrie, not the case. Turns out, 1976, she had never actually seen the Indianapolis Motor Speedway before her arrival.
I had never seen the place until the day I came to Indianapolis to interview with Bryant Heating and Cooling. They wanted to make sure I would represent them well enough. And on that day, one of their executives showed me the Speedway. It was so astonishing. I'd never seen anything that resembled it. I'd been flying since I was a small kid, and as we started down the back straight in the Bryant executive's Pinto, I thought, I've taken off in small airplanes from runways shorter than this straightaway.
The place is massive, Mike, no question about that. And so too were the storylines in 1977, because clearly the, you know, pursuit of qualifying for Janet Guthrie was a big storyline there in her second year at the Speedway after being introduced to it and seeing it in 1976. But the big storyline initially in 1977 was that happened on pole day with another landmark event.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have audio, and I wish we did. I wish we had audio of that, first 200-mile-an-hour lap that Tom Sneva did. I mean, it's part of those, you know, the dynamic films and the films that they did every year, but it's, you know, it's more of a post-production thing. I wish we had, you know, live audio of Tom Sneva doing that historic lap. I think that would be really cool to have.
So Tom Sneva's 200-mile-an-hour lap was obviously a benchmark. He got the 200 silver dollars from Tony Holman, famously pouring them out of a helmet. But once that was secured, then the storyline became, would Janet Guthrie qualify for the 1977 Indianapolis 500? And the answer is right here.
Well, that was just an amazing day. Qualifying was the greatest moment. The previous weekend, the 22nd of May, 77, I think any driver of that era would tell you the moment they first put a car in the field for Indianapolis with a time fast enough to be perfectly secure. I mean, back then, there were 90 cars entered, and only the fastest 33 would start. That's a moment you'll never forget. Race day, as Johnny Rutherford rightly said, some races you psych yourself up for. Indianapolis, you have to psych yourself down.
You know, it's interesting, Mike, because with Janet Guthrie and now in the field and in the race, I want to go back to something she mentioned about A.J. Foyt. You know, A.J. Foyt was larger than life in clearly 1977, but throughout that time period, as he still is to a large extent, but at the in the apex of his driving career at Indianapolis. And I think that the outsider stereotype or observation of A.J. Foyt would be that he would have been the most gruff in this change of a woman within the field of the Indianapolis 500. But while there were eyebrows raised about Janet Guthrie, I think that A.J. Foyt allowing Janet Guthrie to go out, even just symbolically, to go out and, quote, shake down one of his cars was kind of a message to everybody of this is a driver, not necessarily a woman. That went a long way, I think, in the acceptance of Janet Guthrie.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. And you're right. I think people would think stereotypically, you know, AJ is this, you know, gruff, kind of grouchy, tough guy, and he wouldn't want to have anything to do with Janet Guthrie. And the fact that he let Janet Guthrie drive his car in practice, and she showed that she could, you know, with the speed she showed that day, she could have made the race. And so I think it did go a long way to say, hey, you know, you give Janet Guthrie a good car, she's a race driver. I mean, this is not a novelty act. This is a person who could definitely put a car in the show. And I think you're 100% right. You know, that definitely went a long way to helping Janet Guthrie.
Of course, then the question became, now that Janet Guthrie had made the field in 1977, it was such a famous phrase, still is, within the world of motorsport, of gentlemen, start your engines. But now you have 32 gentlemen and one woman. So what would the phrasing be from Tony Holman? That was the big question as to how exactly he would address the field for the 1977 Indianapolis 500. And this is how it sounded.
Time for the words. We have all been waiting to hear from Mr. Tony Holman.
In company with the first lady ever to qualify at Indianapolis, gentlemen, start your engine.
And so that's how it sounded from Tony Holman in 1977. But Janet Guthrie would explain in that interview with Terry Stacey, there was a lot more that went into it before those words were uttered.
Well, that was the last year that Tony Holman called the start. And he had threatened to go ahead and say, gentlemen, start your engines, because he said the mechanics started the engines. They had no onboard starters. And Kay Bignotti came to me and said, we can't let Tony get away with this. Kay was the daughter of three-time winner Louis Meyer and married to the famous master mechanic George Bignotti. She said, I have 50-pound bags of feed for the horses all the time. I'll start your engine. So Tony had to think of something, and what he came up with was, in company with the first lady ever to qualify at Indianapolis, gentlemen, start your engines.
Okay.
Then Tony passed away that fall, and subsequently, when I was in the field, Mary Holman, his widow, simply said, lady and gentlemen. But to answer your initial question, you don't hear it. You simply don't hear it. The mechanics hear it, and what you're listening for is the sound of your engine starting to spin so that you can give it a little throttle and get the engine running.
Mike, I think the thing that I personally love about this program, and I hope that people enjoy this as well, but to hear the audio is one thing, but then to hear the archive of the people involved telling the backstory to it. You know, there's always a little bit more to the story, if you will. Pretty fascinating from Janet Guthrie just to hear about everything that went into, and whoever would have guessed, right, that there would be something as simple as a command to start a race that would be so impactful and meaningful and symbolic, historically speaking, and something that we would be talking about nearly 50 years later.
Absolutely right. And what's interesting is it really was a big deal that week. Once she made the race, you had a week before the race, obviously. And I mean, if you go back, you can look in the newspapers where it was, you know, what's Tony going to say? That was a storyline that was, you know, being written about. So to say it was a big story, I mean, that was accurate. And people wanted to know what's Tony going to say for the command. So, you know, it really was a big deal.
Janet Guthrie accomplishing a first in the 1977 Indianapolis 500. There would be another rookie, so to speak, involved with the race that would become a key figure at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll tell you about that, and we'll continue to look at the other historical anecdotes in this look back at the 1977 Indy 500 on Beyond the Bricks.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Uh-oh. Did you miss the Real ID May 7th deadline? Real ID compliant licenses and ID cards feature a gold star in the upper right corner. If yours doesn't have one, you can't board commercial aircraft or gain access to any federal facilities. Get yours updated now. To obtain a Real ID for the first time, you must visit a driver's license service center in person. For full details, visit flhsmv.gov/realid. That's flhsmv.gov/realid. Paid for by the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, Beyond the Bricks, taking a look back at 48 years ago, the 1977 Indianapolis 500 mile race, where we talked about the fact it was a historic race from the standpoint of Janet Guthrie becoming the first female to race and qualify for the Indianapolis 500 mile race. But she was not the only one that was in getting involved, if you will, in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway within her role for the very first time. That's because much of the audio that you hear, certainly from the radio standpoint, has Paul Page as the chief announcer. It was not always anticipated going into the 1977 race, certainly as of April, just a month before, that that would be the case. But Paul Page himself, if you will, making history and becoming the second, Mike, chief announcer of the radio network in that race.
Yeah, that's the case. Unfortunately, Sid Collins passed away just a few days before practice opened for the 1977 Indianapolis 500. And you know, all of a sudden, you know, the network, the radio network, loses its leader just as the month of May is opening. So just a terrible situation for the network. Now, Sid had basically appointed Paul Page as his successor kind of in waiting. So, you know, Paul knew that he was going to at some point be the voice. He just didn't know it was going to be as quickly as it sadly ended up becoming.
Paul Page on exactly that. The assumption that the man that would appoint him indirectly, if you will, as his successor, simply put, Paul thought he would have more time with Sid Collins.
No, Sid was a young man, and I thought that I was probably going to be his understudy for 10 or 12 years at least. He was in his 50s, so he had plenty of time to spend, and unfortunately, he was overtaken by amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, the Lou Gehrig's disease, and that took his life.
And so, with Sid Collins handing over that torch, I guess, symbolically, and then, you know, Paul Page in the unique circumstance, the tragic circumstance that he just mentioned, taking over, Paul Page becomes the chief announcer of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. But in an interview with Mike, Paul talked about the fact that Sid was certainly a mentor to him as a broadcaster.
I was working at WIBC and in the news department, and he was my mentor. He started several years, he brought me onto the network in 1974. And in 75 and 76, he spent a lot of time with me, both here at the radio station, but also at the track when we were doing reports and qualifying days, grooming me, teaching me how to interview, hopefully how to call a race, what things were important, how you put things together. And so, yeah, he set me up for this, and it was his specific request that I be the successor.
So that's how it would come to be, that Paul Page would take over in 1977. And as you can imagine, in the month of May, everything centers around the Indianapolis 500. As Mike had mentioned, it was May 2nd of that year when Sid Collins would pass away. And so you have now a race broadcast where, especially for race fans, many of which that may not have known of Sid's health complications, that there was a change within the radio booth. So the 1977 Indianapolis 500, the IMS Radio Network, paid tribute to their missing voice.
Sid Collins, the voice of the 500 for almost 30 years, is not here with us today. But I'm sure in spirit he is cheering for all this broadcast crew. He was that type of man. Today in spirit, he has the safety of all these fine drivers in mind. He was that type of man. Through the many years here at the 500, Sid was an advisor, brother, father, and counselor for drivers, mechanics, and all of us on the broadcast crew. His advice and counsel will remain with all of us through the years. His ability as a fine broadcaster will remain with you listeners for a long time. He was a perfectionist. He accepted a job to do. The job was well done. May 2nd, Sid Collins passed away. He had contracted ALS, the Lou Gehrig disease. We'll miss Sid Collins. He was our friend, but he was a friend of yours too. Sid was a man of great ability, articulate, and a gentleman through and through. But Sid Collins knew that no man is indispensable, and will be cheering all of us on to do a good job like he always wanted us to do. Now, please join all of us in a moment of silence in memory of Sid. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And now, here is Sid's good friend, race driver, broadcaster, and a well-qualified man, in our new voice of the 500, Paul Page.
Thank you very much, Jim Shelton, and greetings from Indianapolis. This broadcast crew deeply feels the loss of our leader, Sid Collins, and we are here today going to perform in the way that he would have wanted us to, the way that he taught all of us for many, many years. We hope that you will join with us in dedicating this 61st running of the 500-mile race to Sid Collins.
Jim Shelton, Paul Page from the 1977 Indianapolis 500-mile race. Obviously a race from the broadcast standpoint, and certainly just in terms of the familial aspect of the event, one with great loss and tragedy with the passing of Sid Collins. But there was the dichotomy there, because it was also a race, as Paul Page would explain, between Janet Guthrie and other aspects of storylines, Tom Sneva that we talked about, that had a triumphant side as well.
No, it was the story laid out perfectly for me and made the whole concept, because Sid took his life in early May and made the whole job, which was a heavy burden at that time, made it so much easier because there was something to talk about. There were beautiful stories to be played. And then at the end of the race, and we were in the old master control tower, and they used to pull the winner right up at the base of that, up on a platform. And so A.J. Foyt's looking right up at me. I'm looking down on one of the greatest drivers that ever lived, making history, his fourth win, the first time anybody won four Indy 500s. And just, I mean, the whole thing, it was wonderful. It was an incredible experience and a tremendous relief that at least I got that one done. Who knows what the future is, but this one worked out pretty well because they gave me the clay.
And the clay would mold itself, Mike, let's be realistic here, into one of the most incredible and historic races in 500 history.
Absolutely. I mean, you had, as they said, so many different storylines, and Paul Page, you know, they're put in a really difficult position because Sid is gone. And Paul Page, you know, he changed the way the broadcast was done because obviously Sid did it as more of a master of ceremonies. You know, these things have occurred where Paul moved it into the play-by-play era that we know it today. So it was a big change, and the broadcast crew had to deal with a lot of change. But, you know, they did it flawlessly, and an incredible job they did in 1977.
And in terms of all that went into that, as Paul would tell Mike, in an interview, Mike, that you had conducted with Paul Page, it meant a lot to everybody, that 77 race. It certainly meant a lot to Paul Page as well.
You've talked, I know, so many times about how much the Indianapolis Motor Speedway means to you, and you can hear it in your voice when AJ comes across the line for that fourth win. AJ Foyt at Indianapolis. It wasn't AJ Foyt wins the race, it was Indianapolis, and you really brought that home that day.
Well, it's actually a combination. Yeah, I was very emotional that it was AJ, and when it hit on me that he was the potential winner, and I realized we had a four-time winner coming up here, that all was overwhelming me, but also something that Sid taught, which is don't go to the obvious. Don't if play your tapes back, and if you find out that every year you've said the same thing on a winner, then you've done it wrong. And so I was very conscious of that, and I've been conscious of those kind of lessons ever since.
1977, as you heard there, the year that AJ Foyt would become a four-time winner at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But the race itself had even more history beyond that. We'll continue taking a look back on it on this episode of Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Uh-oh, did you miss the Real ID May 7th deadline? Real ID compliant licenses and ID cards feature a gold star in the upper right corner. If yours doesn't have one, you can't board commercial aircraft or gain access to any federal facilities. Get yours updated now. To obtain a Real ID for the first time, you must visit a driver's license service center in person. For full details, visit flhsmv.gov/realid. That's flhsmv.gov/realid. Paid for by the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Landon Coons is the producer that puts everything together in terms of Beyond the Bricks. He is kind of like, if you will, Han Solo flying the Millennium Falcon for us. Mike Thompson and myself, Jake Query, that would make, I guess I'm Chewbacca. I don't know what that makes Mike Thompson. But we are all inside of the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. Mike, is there any particular, would you be Luke Skywalker then? Is that right?
Yeah, that'd be fine. I'm fine with being Luke Skywalker. I mean, he's Han Solo, you're Chewbacca, I'm Luke Skywalker. That's cool.
I just stand and make awkward noises, right?
I don't know if I want to be one of the Ewoks, but.
That's right. Well, hey, we're taking a look back actually around that time, 1977, the 1977 Indianapolis 500-mile race. So only fitting that we would mention Star Wars within the conversation. The race, of course, took place on May 29th of that year. It was, as Paul Page, you heard say, the 61st running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. We talked about the fact that Janet Guthrie started the race. That was the big first historical marker. But perhaps that was even preceded by the fact that Tom Sneva had broken the 200-mile-an-hour barrier. But the race itself is one that would come down to some of the biggest names, some of the biggest players in the race. Gordon Johncock, A.J. Foyt, Tom Sneva, all battling it out here, and there was a lot going on within that race and within the different stars of the race and things affecting them throughout the 500 miles, Mike.
That's correct. First, I want to point out that I'm so old, I saw Star Wars at the Showcase Cinema in 1977 in Toledo, so I'm that old.
I actually saw it in the theater as well, so I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I just want to point that out. But yeah, you're right. There was a lot going on. And people don't realize how kind of sick Gordon Johncock was at the end of that race in 1977. He was suffering from dehydration and, he had heat exhaustion and he was really not doing very well. They were pouring like buckets of water on him. And his last pit stop, you could see they physically just throw water on him in the cockpit to try to cool him down because he was really struggling with heat-related issues at the end of that race.
Gordon Johncock would lead on five different occasions for 129 laps in that 1977 Indianapolis 500-mile race. But as you talked about, Mike, so hot, and obviously, the heat in general, that also would be the case for his car. And once on lap 184, Gordon Johncock's car had had enough, so too had he when he would jump into the creek at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the infield just to cool off. Gordon Johncock dropping out of the race.
So the chase is on, but Gordon Johncock has pulled over to the left side of the straightaway. He appears to be slowing. He has cut his car in off of the apron at the south end of the main straightaway. A.J. Foyt is now our leader. There is apparently something wrong in Gordon Johncock's car. We see the... We see Gordon Johncock climbing out of his machine at the moment on the grass that used to be Victory Lane here at Indianapolis. It is not Victory Lane for Gordon Johncock.
So Gordon Johncock would be denied in 1977, and as you heard Paul Page mention, on lap number 185, A.J. Foyt would take over the race lead. In an interview with Mike, A.J. talked about just that pursuit, that chase, the reeling in of Gordon Johncock.
In 75, we should have won 76, but we run out of fuel twice. 77, we run out of fuel, and we got 32 seconds down, and we knew we were faster than McNaughty, and my chief mechanic, Jack Storms, which he still works for me in Houston, he says, I said, they'll let us get within 10 seconds, and then they'll turn the boost up, and I'll turn my boost up. That time you can run whatever boost, but I didn't want to take a chance of breaking a motor before I got close to him. It went 10, 8, 9. I was catching him on 2 seconds left. Jack said, if you turn the boost up, I said, no. I said, they got to be in trouble. And then he blew up because I knew Big Naughty, knowing the way I raced, he wasn't going to let me get within 10 seconds of him because I kind of knew how he operated before when I'd be way out in lead. He said, back off. And then, all right, start picking it up. And that's where we worked good together. And that's the reason I said to Jack, which catched him pretty quick. I said, and they let me get him about 10 seconds. Then he'll send guard. Well, I guess he was in trouble before that. I did not know that. And Jack then thought I turned the boost up. I said, no, I'm still running the same boot. I said, they got to be in trouble.
Yeah, what
I mean?
So, absolutely.
And then it come apart. The motor did.
It's interesting because I think, with A.J. Foyt in particular, and let's focus on that for a second, Mike. A.J. Foyt now, a 90-year-old man, still a legend of the Speedway, still actively around and one that you can see and one that fans still can, see on a golf cart on pit road, whether it be at Indianapolis or occasionally now, not with the same frequency, but still involved with the race team around the track. So much of, and I'm going to use the word stereotype, although there's a truth to it, so much of the myth, if you will, around A.J. Foyt, of Foyt getting out and, banging on the car with a wrench or getting out and being upset with a mechanic or being critical of the performance of his car and those things. So much of that, I think, was developed within that three-year window we just heard him talking about. Such the peaks and the valleys in the mid-70s of A.J. Foyt that I think really catapulted him into the American culture as this superhero figure that was one that people related to because they loved a guy that wasn't afraid to let all the emotion show on his sleeve.
Oh, 100%. I mean, he was an everyman, he worked his way up everyman, and who hasn't gotten out of the car and kicked the car if it wasn't working right? And he did that and, pulled out a wrench and did it himself, things like that. But that clip's really also important because you know, he and Big Noddy won a lot of races together. So he knew how Big Noddy operated. So, you know, that's that clip gives you a little insight because he knew, you know, he and Big Noddy worked together really well, won a lot of races together. So he knew, you know, hey, Big Noddy's not going to let me get within 10 seconds. So all of a sudden when he's 3 or 4 seconds behind, he knew, okay, Gordy's got a problem and that he was going to be there to capitalize on when John Cock dropped out.
And so that's exactly what he would do. AJ Foyt, for the last 15 laps of that race, has number 4 in pursuit. And Paul Page was able to call it.
A.J. Foyt approaching his 4th win at Indianapolis. It given to him when Gordon Johncock's engine failed just several laps ago. The white flag is waved for A.J. Foyt. Here is Ron Carroll.
All right, Paul, thank you. We have him in the view. And, hey, this is going to be the first guy to win over $1 million at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. With this 4th win, he's over in turn 2. How did Bell pick him up?
Riding smoothly around the line, drifts back out to the wall, up the backstretch to Darrell Weibel.
From the dusty tracks of Texas to Racing's Hall of Fame, and there goes Foyt toward turn 3, Doug Zink.
And the crowd on its feet is A.J. Foyt. They're waving at him, waving him on through turn number 3, off of 3, into the short chute. Here's Jim Shelton.
Hey, the crowd is up there cheering, as you can hear in the background. Not only the eyes of Texas, but the eyes of the world are on this great man. And now to call the checkered flag, our chief announcer, who did call a great race today, Paul Page.
A.J. Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. AJ's hand in the air. He is the winner. AJ Foyt at Indianapolis has won his 4th 500-mile race.
One of the great lines I thought from that race was afterwards when Paul Page was discussing AJ Foyt slowly coming down in towards victory lane, saying that he no longer needs the speed from that car because he is now a 4-time winner at Indianapolis. Ron Carroll, Howdy Bell, Darrell Weibel, Doug Zink, Jim Shelton, Paul Page, all of the IMS Radio Network on that historic call. And there was so much celebration. I can still remember as a kid. And Mike, I don't know if this would have been the case for you in Toledo or not, but I remember, of all things, the book fair. The book that would the mobile, you know, unit that would come to schools.
Yeah, the Scholastic Book Fair. Yeah,
the Scholastic
absolutely.
Book Fair. Yep. And it was at the Scholastic Book Fair that I was able to buy a poster that was a reprint, if you will, in poster size of the Indianapolis Star front page. Simply, you know, Foyt winning his 4th Indianapolis 500 with the photo. It was such a historic event. But with all of that and all of the celebration and the photos that would become iconic and frozen for a lifetime to commemorate all of it, what nobody realized was that they were getting ready to see almost a spontaneous celebration that itself would, in the theme of 1977 with dichotomy, have its own yin and yang, if you will, of it being a poignant moment, but a historic one because of the sad nature of it that would come not long after. And I'm talking about what happened with Tony Holman, of course, Mike, and AJ Foyt after the race.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, Tony had ridden in the car a couple of times, but he had never ridden for the victory lap on the back of the car, to my knowledge, until he did that with AJ Foyt. And he was extremely close with AJ Foyt. Their families were close. And he, I mean, he loved AJ Foyt, and AJ Foyt loved Tony Holman. Tony Holman, or AJ referred to him as Mr. Holman. You know, I mean, they were very, very close. So it was a truly special moment when Tony Holman climbed up on the back of the car. And what fans didn't know is that this would be the last time they would see him, most likely, because you know, most fans would go to the race and then they would come back to the race the next year and things like that. They wouldn't necessarily see Tony Holman until the next year. Well, unfortunately, Tony Holman passed away later that year. So this was the last opportunity most fans, they didn't know at the time, had to see Tony Holman. And it was with AJ Foyt on the back of the pace car.
And when you talk about, by the way, before we hear that, Mike, Tony Holman and just his relationship with AJ Foyt, it was beyond, for those, and I would imagine most listening to us right now are familiar with this, but it was beyond just a friendship. I mean, there were different periods where AJ Foyt, if I'm not mistaken, you correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, he had Tony Holman had taken him in and allowed him to live, you know, on their property during times when he was in Central Indiana. I mean, it literally was maybe mentor is too strong, but, you know, kind of a father-son type relationship.
Oh, no, they were family, basically. You know, I mean, he was like a almost like a second father to AJ. I mean, they were very, very close. There's no question that AJ Foyt, you know, he absolutely adored Tony Holman. There's no doubt about it. They were exceptionally close. And Tony Holman felt the same way. I mean, he was just beaming. If you see the pictures of Tony Holman in Victory Lane, and you see the pictures of him after the race, he's just beaming with happiness about how excited he is that AJ Foyt has accomplished this historic feat.
AJ Foyt on that historic ride with Tony Holman in 1977.
I would have to say that would rank with all the special moments. I guess being fortunate enough to make the race here, the race, not win, was one of the big moments of my life. And then be fortunate enough to win it the first time, and then be fortunate enough to be the four-time winner first, and Mr. Holman right around, yeah. They both rank about the same.
It would be, by the way, the Oldsmobile Delta 88 was the pace car in which they would ride together. And as you had talked about, Mike, and we can get a little bit further into this, so many people with the Indianapolis 500 mile race, I think one of the things that makes it so special is it is the time of year where oftentimes you hear people, I will give you an example, and I've mentioned this before, the Dogs of Mussman. How do the Dogs of Mussman relate to what we're talking about tonight? Well, let me explain. The Dogs of Mussman were a group of race fans that primarily in the 70s and through the 80s, would gather every year and have their same spot in turn three in the infield. And they came from all different areas, different towns, different neighborhoods, different backgrounds. But they had all met at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, become friends with one another. And so, therefore, they would meet on Mussman Street in Speedway before on race morning to go in and get their land, if you will, and find out the spot where they would spend race day. And that is so symbolic, I think, for the event itself of what it means for people, because oftentimes you go and you're with your family for that day. And by that, I mean the people who sit near you that you see once a year. For many people, Tony Holman was kind of the master of ceremonies of said event. They would see him once a year. And Mike, I think probably for most, understandably so, it was just an understood that you would see the master of ceremonies and the host of this big party again the next year. And no one realized that that was, for many of them, the final time they would see Tony Holman.
Yeah, that's the case. And I mean, think about the fact that it had to have been a double shock, because there were a lot of people who tuned in for the radio broadcast, and Sid was the audio master of ceremonies. And if you didn't see it in the newspaper, I mean, when Sid passed away, it was in the New York Times. You can look in the New York Times the next day, and there was an obituary for Sid in there mentioning that he had, you know, he had passed away. So it made, you know, national news, if you will, on that. But if you didn't happen to have seen that, you tune in for the radio broadcast, and the first thing you hear is Jim Shelton saying, you know, Sid's not here and he's gone. And that must have been a terrible shock if you didn't know the news. And then the next year, Tony Holman's not there. So like the two, like what you're talking about, the two masters of ceremonies are both gone at the same time. I mean, that must have been a terrible shock for fans, I think.
And thinking about the fact of just seeing that lap, the jubilation of it all, right? Sometimes, Mike, I think it's best to just look at a moment and not even, you know, not even necessarily go to why it was so special, but rather soak in the beauty of it in that moment. The reason partially that lap was so special is because of the fact that Tony Holman would be lost. But in the moment itself, when you look at it, that is purely however long it took them to do that lap. That particular moment when you watch it is two people where you can see the absolute jubilation. Now, the question becomes, Mike, was 1977, when you think about the speed barrier, you think about Janet Guthrie, you think about Tony Holman, you think about AJ Foyt's fourth win, is it the most non-1911 historic race in the history of the Speedway?
I think it is. I think it's one of the most important, if it's not, I think it is the most important race. I think you could make a case for the first race of the Holman era being an important race, obviously, because without Tony Holman, we're not on this show right now, you know, because Tony Holman. And I think that also comes back to what you're just talking about how important that lap was, because the fans had an opportunity to clap for AJ Foyt, his historic fourth win, and talk about how wonderful that was and that accomplishment. But it also was almost an affirmation and a thank you to Tony Holman. You know, thank you for saving this place. Thank you for all you've done. Thank you for all the accommodations you've done for us and everything you've done for us, Tony Holman. Now, not knowing that this is the last time you're going to see Tony Holman, but that it's almost how that felt a little bit was, you know, hey, thank you, Tony, because, you know, Tony Holman wasn't a guy who was always out there in the spotlight. He wasn't a guy who's constantly, he wasn't a showman or anything like that. I mean, he preferred to be behind the scenes, but he was one of those guys that it gave them an opportunity to thank him.
And, of course, in bookmarking the four-time winners, Elio Castroneves would win his fourth when everyone would again resume after the pandemic in that race. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
Uh-oh, did you miss the Real ID May 7th deadline? Real ID compliant licenses and ID cards feature a gold star in the upper right corner. If yours doesn't have one, you can't board commercial aircraft or gain access to any federal facilities. Get yours updated now. To obtain a Real ID for the first time, you must visit a driver's license service center in person. For full details, visit flhsmv.gov/realid. That's flhsmv.gov/realid. Paid for by the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles.